sense feminism socializes women to look inwards, to reinvent themselves, and ask questions like, who are we? Where are we coming from? And where are we going? The theory wants women to partner not only with other women, but also with men on the basis of equality in order to dismantle patriarchal practices that harm, restrict, limit, and oppress women and truncate their desire to grow and develop their potentials. There was need to come up with a feminist concept or theory that is Afrocentric and specifically Igbocentric, an indigenous model that would privilege indigenous knowledge. This would be a way of decolonizing feminism to tailor it to our needs in our part of the world. The advocacy for indigenous perspective would bring about the conservation of indigenous knowledge as well as the archiving of indigenous knowledge systems.
Women of Africa, we are being called into healing, a great healing. There is a rebirth that will need to take place. And so in entering the journey of rebirth, we may need to go back into the womb, and the womb is Africa. And Africa will begin with the soil, because without the soil, without the ground, without the rooting, there cannot be a rebirth. And we will need to find, as the Sawiras, as the leaders, as the women who have been called for a time such as this, across the generations, there truly is hope for Africa. So we cannot give up now.
Always draw from those women who have always been taken a position of power, those who have been in the warrior spirit, those who have been fighting for justice. So when we are also doing it, that we are cultivating and awakening this spirit within us so that we can be faced with the challenges that we are facing today, we can be able to know how to deal with them. In the Kandaka circle, the way we conduct it, one of the things that we do, we are drawing an understanding from African tradition, African culture, and African culture for healing. And doing that, for me, it has always been a concern that every time when we are faced with challenges, we tend to approach those challenges as if like we never had processes of solution in our society. And it is because just we have forgotten all these ways and intervention that have always been there. And sometimes you realize that not tapping into them, it's one of the things that makes us more confused. We feel like we don't have answers, while the answers are there, but we don't know how to go into those answers and unlock them.
Academia should be a community of education, knowledge exchanges between scholars and support in an environment that is often international and attracting diverse knowledges. Then what is our subjectivity and position and action towards minority and racialized members of our community that are even more disempowered when left alone, dealing with institutions and racist members of the society? Unfortunately, anti-racist minority studies and all the other studies in white academic settings, often they do not differ in their ways of being than other scholars, as they maintain a distinction between being and studying, theorizing and practicing, working on data or case studies and within communities, networking and deeply connecting one another.
Welcome to another edition of SciPod, Sawira Africa International Podcast. My name is Amgelon Begini Kapanen, your host. In honor of Black History Month, we bring you yet another offering featuring voices of great women from all corners of the globe and all walks of life who graced us with their presence and shared their knowledge and wisdom at the Sawira Global Summit, which was held on the 24th and 25th of May in 2022. The theme of the summit was Decolonize the Mind, Healing the Feminine, Rebirth New Perspectives, Recreate Ourselves. It was organized in partnership with the Center for Research on Ethnic Relations and Nationalism, CERN, the Swedish School of Social Science, and the University of Helsinki. In this installment, we get yet another taste of what was offered at this auspicious summit. We are offered an opportunity to hear the thought-provoking and highly edifying talk between Dr. Faith Mkhwesha and Mujare Panache Shigumadzi. Both of these ladies need no introduction, as their reputations precede them. However, I shall take the liberty to introduce them nonetheless. Dr. Mkhwesha is an African Black decolonial feminist, social justice activist, researcher and lecturer. She's the founder and director of the Sawira Africa International NGO. Mujare Panache Shigumadzi is the author of These Bones Will Rise Again, and her 2015 debut novel, Sweet Medicine, won the 2016 K. Selodeka Literary Award. She was the founding editor of Vanguard magazine, a platform for Black women coming of age in post-apartheid South Africa, a columnist for the New York Times and contributing editor of the Johannesburg Review of Books. Her work has featured in titles including The Guardian, Chimurenga, Africa is a Country, Boston Review, Transition, Washington Post, and Desate. There's so much more we could mention about both ladies because they have such illustrious bios, but in the interest of time, we shall go on to hear their conversation.
I am very thrilled today to be talking to Panache. I've been following your work and I found your trajectory amazing. The way I've described you to some of my students, I've said that Panache no Shikirwa. So I have explained to them that there's no young person who can engage with them with the depth of heritage and knowledge and spirituality and metaphors and history and even get deeper into even the effects of enlightenment the way you have done. Panache is an essayist, she's a novelist, she's a media person, and she's done a lot. So Panache, I'll ask you this question. What has inspired you to choose to take this path that is very intellectual, that is also very creative, that is also very kind of academic and spiritual and historical, which is so wide, and you are doing it so well? And I can only say, no, Shikino.
You know, you honestly just brought tears to my eyes because kuti ndiri kushrikirwa, meaning that it's not kushrikirwa. For those of you who don't know, Shona kushrikirwa is to be arrived upon. If you think about Haitian spirituality, it's to be mounted by the spirit. And that really means ultimately that you're a vessel. You can only hope to be a worthy vessel because it means that the work is not your own. And at best, your work as a medium really is to find yourself worthy of doing that and making sure that you can listen beyond the things that you might want to do, but there's spirit that tells you to do particular kinds of things. So I'm just really, first of all, let me just say, I'm really honored to be in conversation with you, Mkhwesha. Your work has been really important to my work. I remember, you know, when I wanted to begin doing the work that would eventually lead to the basis for These Bones Will Rise Again, looking at your work on Zimbabwean literary imagination, particularly how you looked at Yvonne Vera, thinking about the frozen image. That's something that comes a lot in These Bones Will Rise Again. If you go back to my master's thesis, that specifically engages that. It's also in the bibliography of the book. So the reason why we're here is because of the path that you have created for us, showing that it is possible. And this work is generational work. And I think that's a key part of what I'm trying to emphasize in These Bones Will Rise Again, that this is intergenerational work. So I'm so glad to be in conversation with you today because your generation has done so much for us. And I'm glad for us to be together. So it's such an honor to be in conversation with you today. I think it would be strange for me to kind of reverse engineer how I got into this. I mean, there is, of course, I can say the easy thing is to say that, you know, history, English, those were my favorite subjects at school. History in particular was one way in which I was trying to make sense of all the different changes amongst, well, that were happening the rupture. So one of them, of course, being the fact that I grew up in South Africa in large part. And although a lot of my work, particularly, I mean, I think of myself as I'm an African first and foremost, but I know you can't tell that to border control. So concretely, I was born in Zimbabwe, grew up in South Africa. But I think two key things brought me to the subject of history. It was going up, in Limpopo province, in Polokwane, near the Beitbridge border post, which is the busiest border post in Africa, and it particularly became the busiest border post in the aftermath of land reform, right, in Zimbabwe. And that was a particular kind of era in which I had to all of a sudden grow up or come to reckon with people calling me a gwere gwere and all of those things, and thinking about the so-called border jump and really trying to make sense of how do we get to this particular point? How do we understand what land reform is? How do we understand the particular position? I know I grew up in my parents' nostalgia about the Zimbabwe that they grew up in. So I was trying to make sense of that, and history is one way. On the other hand, within South Africa in particular, you know, the particularly racist history. I mean, it's not unique to South Africa, but there are particular kinds of ways in which you're trying to make sense of who you are. And if you were to look at, you know, the day-to-day, everything about South Africa would tell you that Black people, or everything about South Africa speaks to the anti-Blackness. I mean, this is not unique to South Africa, but I think South Africa is very overt in that. And in order to make sense of, well, no, this is not inherent in us. Our particular position as Black people is not inherent. How do I make sense? And I think history has been one way for me to understand that nothing is inevitable. Apartheid, colonialism beginning in 1652, that was in somebody's mind, somebody envisioned a particular way of doing these things. And so how do we have a vision for what we're doing? You cannot do this without having a keen sense of history. So that's how I get into history as a subject matter. I studied accounting, that's a whole other story of how I eventually come into this. But the other part of, I think, specifically the spiritual dimension, I must say that I do believe that it's important to just note that I didn't grow up with Chiwan in this particular way. Of course, we spoke Shona. It was very important for us to always go Kumusha, Kwamurewa, and that kind of thing. So I think the first historians that I knew were my parents telling us, in 1976, there was a Datsa and Watwat and Tete did 1, 2, 3. And so nothing about Zimbabwe was ever abstract to me. I could imagine the country that they grew up in, because my parents were always very deliberate about saying, this is where we grew up to chief Fudzamombe, whatnot, you know, this is where we grew up herding cattle. So all of that kind of history was never abstract to me. Where we were from was something that my parents really instilled in me. And the storytellers I knew were my parents and my mother driving in the car between Durban and Harare, Polokwane and Harare, Kwarusapi, whatever, all of those things. But the key dimension is just to say that I think there's some point in which I began to do a questioning. The first time I really began to question spirituality and religion, I think, is after things fall apart. And that was the first time I really thought, whoa, who were the first Christians in my family? Oh, you know, what was the rupture? Was it my great grandmother? What was it like when they first encountered Wanafata, you know, the fathers of the missionaries and those kind of things? And that really got me to think about that. And that's what you kind of see in Sweet Medicine, which is the first book, thinking about our spirituality. And over time, it's really been my seeking it out, but it's not even my seeking it out. It's been the spirit seeking me out to do this particular work. And I just want to end out there, because it's to say that there's nothing about my upbringing in particular that would have brought me to our indigenous spirituality, in the sense that I grew up, you know, in the Anglican Church, generations of Manyano women or Wadzano women. So they're not, this is, you know, I think the first time I heard about Waroe, Baloi, witchcraft was when I was in my, you know, I was in 11 and we're traveling in Bumba, and I was like, oh my God, I can't imagine this stuff. And that was always the scariest thing to me. But it really, I think that questioning, and I think it's instructive to say that the spirit is never lost. It's just a matter of us finding it. So which is why it really means something for you to say, because it means that the spirit finds us and will meet you wherever you are, whether you're speaking Chirungu or you can't really speak Shona, whether it is that you grew up doing 1, 2, 3. It's not that you have to have a particular kind of background. It's to say that anybody, as long as you have Shungu or you have the desire, the spirit will reach you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm very interested in the sense that you really understand this concept of intergenerational. And I'm happy that you say my work, my PhD thesis has been good for you. And we've got many young who are doing literature. We say that it has been very pivotal. So when I came for the FEMS, I saw many young people coming to me and I said, oh, I'm a celebrity. Now, when you come to the Nordic and you get beaten by racism, you end up not even knowing who are you. So I'm really happy that you are doing this work. And you are building on generation of writers. We look at Tsitsi Langaremba, the first Zimbabwean writer who writes in English. We look at Yvonne Vera, and they develop as we get along. So I found your book very interesting because Yvonne Vera writes Nehanda, and she reignites and reclaims the Nehanda spirit, the African woman warrior who led the first Chimurenga. Yeah. And to see that when I was doing my PhD as well, I read some Dreams of Nehanda. I think it helped me because I was teaching African literature and I was doing all this, but I had never really gone to understand our history. To understand that layout that I put in my thesis. Actually, that layout, when I presented my thesis, they said, this is an impossible thesis. It's too wide. It's not clear. Where is it going? Even myself, I could not explain how it's going to be achievable. But one day when I was walking, I just had an insight that I'm going to have pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial Zimbabwe crisis and all that. And the layout came. And when I arrived to the office, I went to my supervisor. I said, this is the layout of the pieces. And she says, this is brilliant. How did you think about that? Then I was like, I'm not sure whether I really thought about it myself because it just came. So can I claim that I did this myself? Or it was just given to me. And if it was given to me, who gave it to me? That this layout, it was very clear. Even I could even see the layout of my thesis outline. So yeah, this brings me to the concept and to the question to you that you follow on Yvonne Vera, you follow on me, and you come up with this this beautiful book, that memo that you have written, that the historical memo that you have written, these bonds will rise again, that was published in 2019. What was the influence to you to come up with this book? And can you say you created it, or there was spark, or how did this book come into existence?
Yeah. So These Bones Rise Again, you know, is a response, we call it a historical memoir, that reflects on the 2017 coup, not a coup, that ousted Robert Mugabe from power through a reflection. So looking at that two-week coup, not a coup period in Zimbabwe through a panoramic view of history, but particularly thinking about the personal and political history of my grandmother, Mbuya Lilian Chikumadze, who had just passed on a few months before that, as well as looking at the figure of Mbuya Nehanda, who is perhaps the most famous, the most iconic liberation figure in Zimbabwe, anti-colonial figure. Spirit medium, if you might call, which is really an inadequate word, but let's use the English as a spirit medium, to say Manoshri Kirwa, she was the medium of a historical spirit. The medium is really ancillary to the larger historical spirit. And this is what I was interested in the book, is to think about, well, very often our histories of many things, but in particularly Zimbabwe, are very presentist. If you look at, for example, land reform, we think, oh my God, these blacks taking over this land, they're stealing it, blah, blah, blah. But nobody speaks about the long history of land reform that begins not even with the British in the 1890s. We can talk about the Portuguese and the Prazos and all of that kind of land confiscation that was happening many centuries before, but yet we can only understand the crisis of the 2000s through that frame. And that's not just white historians, and very often the story of Zimbabwe, as many Black Zimbabwean scholars have shown, has been through the story of white victimhood. We had a farm in Africa, that kind of thing. So going through this book was to decide, well, how do I look at this 2-week period of a coup, not a coup, and think about what is the long history that leads us to this point? And I think that was really important, because I remember that point, this was a lot of pressure to be pro Mnangagwa, open for business, that kind of thing. But yet if we don't pay attention to history, we're going to get the very same outcomes that we have in this moment. But more functionally, what we did have in that moment is that I knew Ella Wakatama Alfrey, or Emma Wakatama, who's a really, really important figure and editor, also Zimbabwean, her father as well, important figure as well, Wakatama as well, who has done really important work as a journalist in Zimbabwe. So again, her genius is not spontaneous. It is also generational, right? Because I think that's the myth of the West, is to decide that genius is always of the individual and it's spontaneous. It is always the work of generations. So she comes from that lineage. And I'd met her sometime in London. And for whatever reason, I decided to sort of, I would say, vomit and just tell her all about my thesis work, which was my master's thesis was specifically looking at Yvonne Vera and Charles Samupindi's fictional, it's not even fictional, it's not even the right word, but their storytelling and their novels around the trial and hanging of Mbuya Nehanda, who was an anti-colonial figure who was executed in 1898 for her role in what we know as the first Chimurenga, the first major colonial uprising, anti-colonial uprising in Zimbabwe. And of course, I correct that in the book. It's not the first, but that's part of the discussion. We can just talk about that later. Ella then, a few weeks after the coup, not a coup, and I remember thinking, why did I go and tell her all these things, a year before, bore her in London, telling her about my thesis about Nehanda. And she then came back to me. She said, you know what, I think that it would be great for you to write a response to the coup, not a coup, from your perspective as a so-called born free, someone who has never known any other Zimbabwean presidency beyond that of Mugabe's, right? And so, of course, for me, a large part of my thesis, as someone who grew up in Southern Africa, I'm not just a born free of Zimbabwe, I'm a born free so-called of South Africa. So the idea being that people who are born after independence, people who are born after apartheid, are so-called born free of history. And I understand that being a kind of earnest yet naive desire by our elders for us to be free of the histories that had shackled them. And of course, our generation, this is the generation that's Rhodes Must Fall, Fees Must Fall, that's insisting on history, saying history is not over. We have to deal with it. And so in responding to this, I thought, well, I think the idea is not to be presentist in this idea that, Zimbabwe's future will begin when the old die and the young are born, which is very much part and parcel about how we think about politics. Think, oh, Chamisa, because he's 40 years old, this is the leader of the opposition. He necessarily, by virtue of his age, he's a better leader. By virtue of the fact that these are young people, the virtue of the fact that these people didn't grow up with the racism of their parents, they are not racist. No, history doesn't work like that. And that's why it became important to think about this intergenerationally. Because age and the particular ways in which Western focus on, or the Western obsession with youth, coupled with the sort of ageism of a particular kind of liberation generation who are holding on, they have a death grip on power, and then we have the Western obsession with youth, means that we have a kind of disjuncture between generations. And say, actually, what we do know, if we actually pay attention to what Chimurenga is, we will know that these struggles, revolutionary struggle, is always intergenerational, which is why when the young comrades went to go and fight, they went and made sure that they first spoke to and they consulted with the spirits of the ancestors. So it is the old coming into conversation with the present about the future to come. It is always an intergenerational struggle. And that's what I really wanted to do, is to interrogate what does Chimurenga, which is what the generals in the coup, not a coup, were appropriating. They're calling this a Chimurenga, a next revolution and that kind of thing. And so, well, what does Chimurenga mean to me? What does the small C, not capital C, Chimurenga mean to us as young people, particularly because many of us turned away from history because of the way in which patriotic history has been used against us in the country. And many of us turned away from our tradition, turned away from Nehandas, and say, no, this is our history. And Chimurenga does not just belong to those who held the gun. It does not just belong to ZANU-PF. It does not just belong to, you know, Waripachi Garu. No, it belongs to us. It's not just for Msangano. It is for us, the people. Povo, this is who it is, right? Whether you're in the country or outside of the country, and it's not just for an older generation, it's also part of my generation. And that's what I was interested in doing in These Bones Will Rise Again. Having been commissioned by Ella, who had just started a new publishing house, Indigo Press, she said, hey, I would like you to write an essay. And so, okay, right, let me go back to my master's thesis, which, you know, very much builds upon on Wamkesha's work. And that's how we get These Bones will Rise Again. So in as much as I wrote it very quickly, it is something that I'd been working on really for many years before somebody said, hey, we want an essay, right? So that's how it came about.
It's really good. And I'm very grateful that you have done that, because when I did my thesis, I didn't have an end. I ended on the Zimbabwean crisis. So now I'm putting together the book of my thesis. So now I have a chapter on the coup, not a coup, from you.
I'm looking forward to reading that. I'm so excited to hear that you have a book coming out. Good.
I'll be writing about your book. It's very interesting that you talk about how the young generation has not been exposed enough to this history, but how they are finding themselves. There is a new awakening that is happening in young people who are saying that, no, what you think that is over is not over. We want to know about it. So I would like to ask you, what do you think, what is your advice to young people of your age who want to be writers, who want to be working media, who want to pursue education? You are doing a PhD right now. You are at Harvard. Mm-hmm. What is your advice on how to claim being African?
Right. Well, I think, you know, that's not just a question for people of my generation. I think it's many generations have that question. And just to say, the other thing I was just thinking, I was speaking, that we're not the first generation to have the awakening, right? Because many of the people, the comrades who then went and consulted with the spirits and that kind of thing for the Chimurenga were missionary taught people, right? They were being taught to reject. So they also had to go back to something in a particular moment. You can read people writing about that particular period where those missionary taught, born and bred folks had to decide, actually, Chiwanu is the way that we're going to fight this. So we're not new in this, but in our particular instantiation of this turning back, particularly this Rose Must Fall moment, there is what some people are calling a spiritual turn, people thinking about, well, actually, I want to know about my culture. And some people will be talking about the fact, well, oh, my mother had a calling and she didn't answer it, right? Those things are very much there. And I am now going to answer this calling. And I think, so this is, and I'm saying this to say that, you know, it's all of us deciding to listen to what we're being called to do. Before all these things that you mentioned, whether it's a PhD, whether it's working in media and whatnot, it's just about platform. But ultimately, it's really about listening to your voice, but also listening to what your spirit is telling you. And what I mean by that, and I don't mean that, oh, you must be having visions and all kinds of people think that, oh my God, if I'm not thinking I'm a prophet right now, then this is not going to work. But to speak very concretely, I always go back to what, you know, Bob Marley speaks of, which is, you know, he who feels it knows it, right? Listen to what is stirring within you. Very often what you'll find is that something that you think, this is why feminists say the personal is political. Doesn't mean that we don't have to interrogate that every feeling that you have is right, but it's to say that that stirring is telling you something. And to listen to that, again, I even go back to what Toni Morrison speaks about, which is a knowing so deep is really important. And I say this because very often what happens is that you go into these institutions like your Harvards, like your Wits universities, which is why we're having this movement for decolonization and whatnot. They are very much invested in removing us from that knowing so deep. So there are things that you already know, but you are now beginning to doubt because I don't have Foucault to cite, I don't have Marx to cite, I don't have Derrida to cite, or I don't have some Western father in order for me to legitimate things that we have already known, things that I know from my grandmother, things that I know from my society, right? And I think that's really important because there's a lot of miseducation that you'll get when you come into these spaces. Just to give you something concrete, I did a response to Tsitsi Dangarembwa's her oeuvre. She just lost. Last year won the Pen Pinter Prize. And one of the things that I spoke about specifically, it's going back to the last element, is the last line of the trilogy of her books. And one of the things that the cousin of Tambu tells us is that, my Nini, finally, you've moved away. And I'm really doing a terrible paraphrase. But she said, finally, you've moved from knowledge of the head to knowledge of the heart, right? So you've come back to this. All these years, Tambu Zai, as the archetypal protagonist, has moved through Tsitsidanga Rembwa's books and always looking for education in a particular kind of space and running away from herself effectively. And at the end of this, she comes back to herself. There's a thing my father often speaks about, which is, and he's a doctor, and you know, during the day, you know, on the weekend, he'll say, he's just going to lie down and say, "Chambo terera nyama." I'm going to listen to the flesh. Right? Again, he who feels it knows it. And for me, that's something I always speak to my students about, that when you want to write, begin there. This is not, we know that there's the personal essay industrial complex, a complex, which is very much sort of confessional and a lot of really indulgent work. This doesn't mean, no, it's to say that the personal is a place to begin from which to theorize about the world and to think, well, if this is happening to me, how then do I connect this to other people? So I don't mean it as personal indulgence. It's to say, how do I use my personal and family experience to think about the fact that history is not something that happens out there, it happens here. And how do we use that to open out to the rest of the world? That's what the personal does. That's why we have the slave narratives historically in the Americas. It would say, as told by him, as told by her, to open up into the experiences of enslaved people. So that's very much part of our tradition as African people across the world. It is how do we use the person as political. Bell Hooks also writes about this as well, specifically using that as a way to open up for everybody. So I think that's just one way to just begin thinking about voice. And how, when people say, how do I know what to write about? I'm like, well, I always ask people, what's important to you? What's important to people around you? Start there. It's not about going out there. It's here. And it might sound very airy, but I think that's really, really important. Of course, then we can talk very concretely about, okay, this is what it takes to be a writer. Try these platforms, do 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. But I think in terms of thinking about work that is transformational, I listened to a really great sermon yesterday at one of the commencement speeches where they're speaking about moving away from the idea of wanting to just be successful for the sake of the fact that, okay, I'm going to write, I'm going to sell a lot of books, going to get a great house, whatever. But thinking about the kind of work that's going to be transformational has to start from some kind of grounding, some kind of spiritual grounding. And that's why for me, I can say to you that I have tears in my eyes when you will say to me that and that kind of thing. It's because it's not that I knew the journey would take me here, but what I did know was to listen to something is not, I could feel something's not okay. The restlessness of Neander's bone, something is not okay. And let me begin there. And eventually now I can reverse engineer to say, oh, my work is about spirituality and religion, but now it looks coherent, but it's only 10 years later, it looks coherent, but it didn't seem like that to me. And I've gone through, like I said, so many different parts, accounting, development studies, you know, a whole range of different things, but eventually say, how do you listen to all these things? What I would say just very concretely for people who are young people who want to write, but also even older people want to write, because I think there's no cutoff to say that you decide you want to write. I always tell my mother, I think she'll be a great writer, for example. I think it's just start writing. And before that, read. Read and listen. Reading as a form of listening, because I think the key thing about any form, any tradition, whether you want to be a rapper, whether you want to be a dancer, is to know your tradition. And the traditions you come from. It might be you want to be a musician. You know that you're not a serious rapper if you don't know all the samples. You don't know who are the rappers who came before you, right? That's just, you wouldn't even be known as a serious MC, right? The same thing also applies with writers, that you have to be interested and invested, particularly our African literary traditions, but beyond that, also our oral traditions, also listening to music, listening to song, all the different forms of storytelling, because that is really important as a place to think about. Part of what distinguishes you as a writer, and any artist, is about how do you bring together generations, right? How do you bring together, how do you say, okay, right, I know what, you know, even people can talk about jazz and all of that. You can, the great innovators are those who really knew the standards. And I think that's really important, because very often we shun, again, this thing of prizing the new too much. It's important to know your traditions as a young writer, as an artist, and think about, what am I adding to this tradition, right? You don't just come and decide to push everything out. You start by knowing your tradition, and then you can begin to sort of, you know, dambuzo, throw your plates at the ceiling and all of those kind of things. But it's because he knew his tradition, he can do that, right? And I think that's a really important starting point. But beyond that, then do as much as you can to, you know, write, get your friends to read it, get into the habit of, you know, people reading and giving feedback, and you also giving feedback. That also makes you a better writer in conversation with other people. Also, as much as possible, you know, if you can, you're young, try and get an internship at a newspaper, for example. It is unfortunate right now that the newsrooms are shrinking. But if you, particularly for those of you who are in school and you have the luxury, because it is a luxury to be able to do an unpaid internship, unfortunately, that's how the industry works. It's not an easy one. Try as much as possible to get internships, you know, build your writing skills, whatever it is that you're writing, just get into the habit of acting, because a lot of it is discipline. There are many people who are really, really, I think, much better writers than I'll ever be. But the issue being discipline and making sure that you can get yourself to finish and to actually just get through the judgery of writing, which is why a lot of times a lot of writers are journalists, because when your editor is knocking and says, hey, I've got my deadline, you just have to, to get that done. So I think getting your internships and that sort of thing is really important. Writing for as many different publications as possible, that's good. But yeah, I think we can do a whole course, as a whole another day on, but like, how do you?
Yes, really. But maybe the question that I would like to really ask you, when you write, are you writing consciously, thinking as a woman writer, or are you just writing as a writer?
You know, people who want to transcend their bodies, you know, it's a very white Western thing to say, you know, because that's Descartes. That's I think, therefore I am. So I just exist as, you know, outside of my body, outside of the situation of where I am. Sure, great. I just am fine. But I'm always situated. I'm not necessarily thinking I'm a woman writer or whatever, but I'm always situated in who I am. And Panache being someone who is born in, you know, Zimbabwe at a very particular moment, grew up in South Africa, all of those things are always there. So anybody who wants to do that, I think it's a flight for fantasy to say that you transcend those things. It's dishonest. I always think about Toni Morrison speaking about the fact that being a Black woman writer doesn't mean that it's not a limited place from which to write. In fact, there's so many things that are expansive. And for me, it is very expansive as a Black woman. You know, in slang, we might say, you know, it means you have the range. You know, but it means that, Kuti, I know, for me, having those histories means that my world is so expansive. It means I'm drawing on, you know, my experience of going Kunfudza Mombe type of thing. I also know what it's like to go to Cambridge. I can do all of those things, because all that, you know, very much people think of cosmopolitanism as something that happens out there. I'm so glad that even just within Southern Africa, if you think about the richness of languages and the cosmologies that are captured there. Like when I think about, when I'm listening to music that's Tswana, and I'm like, oh, you know, I love the particular mannerisms of Tswana and Bedi people because they're very specific. Then there's the things that, you know, Zulu and Guni people do. Then there's Shona. And I think it's so, and then I have my friends who are from Nigeria and West Africa and all of those things. And I'm here in the US. It's so wonderful to be able to draw on all these things. That's just within Blackness, mm-hmm. right? So I don't see myself as being limited by these things. I think it's just an expansive way in different worlds, because very often we think that worlds are out there, they're in the Camus, they, you know, in the Western tradition, but there's so many rich things here. So I am always bringing to bear, I always want to be grounded. I don't do my things as much as, yes, I can be, I'm spiritual, whatever, but I ascend from earth into heaven, right? And earth is the ground which I was born in. And that's always the location. I'm always located. It's dishonest and it's dangerous when people deny their location. And that's what the West has always done. It's, and you know, the previous conversation, you're obfuscating your violence when you refuse to announce yourself. It's only us we have to announce ourselves, right? The more marginalized you are, you must announce from whence you you come. But when you are part of power, it doesn't have to announce itself. It's just, it's obvious, you know. But I don't shy away from it. I'm very proud, and I'm very happy to be writing from a very grounded place. And I think that's the space from which we transcend, because very often I think people, you can see, particularly sometimes you get with younger writers, sometimes in this trying to be universal, so-called, you can get writing that's neither here nor there, because you never know what is at stake for you. And this is what I always say to young people, to say that I know many incredibly smart people who can rehearse all the great theories, but when I read their work, I'm bored. And what I mean by that, I'm saying, what is at stake for you? Being smart doesn't actually give you a feeling. When I'm writing, you would say, wow, what is this? Where is this work heading to? And I think that's from having a sense of grounding and knowing what is at stake, whether I agree with the person or not, but I want to know what is at stake for this person when they're writing. And you won't do that when you're trying to be high up, you know, as universal, neither here nor there. It has to come from a place of being grounded.
Exactly. My last question for you now. I read your interesting article in Guardian where you talk, can white South Africa live up to Ubuntu, the African philosophy, to globalized. I found that article very interesting. So I said I want to ask you about it because I want you to comment on it so that some people who have not read it can have access to your thinking. My question is, who were you talking to in this article? And do us who are formerly colonized, who have been, who continue to be targets of this of colonialism and apartheid, do we have a responsibility to educate or to find a way to make the colonizer or the apartheid citizens reconcile
yeah.
us.
So you know, you
the role of Ubuntu here, because remember when they come, actually our Ubuntu is what really becomes a disadvantage for us, because we welcome these people. Mbene and actually said, kill a cow for them. To give them food, because these are guests. She only let her also know these are not good guests, and that's why she told them, no, chase them out. But if we really welcome these people, and it's Ubuntu that he really made us do this. So I just want you to comment a little bit about this.
I think it would be great if we could share the article with the room, just so people get a sense of what it is. So essentially, this piece that I wrote is called Can White South Africa Live Up to Ubuntu, the African Philosophy that Tutu Globalized? So always think about the political economy. I think this is that's in The Guardian. Yeah, perfect. So I think one thing about media is always think about the political economy of publishing, right? So one thing, always know that headlines, I'm always fighting with editors about headlines. Usually you don't get to pick your own headline, right? So I had a very different headline that I had chosen. I said something along the lines of, you know, white South Africa continues to fail, blah, blah, you know, to something like that, right? That was, and they didn't like that. So fine, right? Eventually, this is our midpoint after many tussles. So there's always just, when you're doing, you know, this, and I'm saying this for the broader audience, that very rarely do you choose the article title that you want. I have many atrocious headlines. People didn't come to me and say, it's not me, I promise you. So I always have a headache whenever I publish in popular media because of the constraints of audience and constraints of platform and that kind of thing, which is why it's a serious problem, just to also add, that we don't have our own platforms as Black people. We don't have global media institutions. And it's something that we've become far too comfortable in, this idea of being included into platforms. I'm not really for the school of representation and that kind of thing, because it's meant that our voices are diluted in particular kinds of ways, such that then we're going to do the kind of dancing that you're seeing me do in this piece. The ventriloquizing, I think what I'm doing in this piece is a particular kind of ventriloquizing. That question, can white South Africa live up to Ubuntu, is a rhetorical question, which should, having gone through that, the piece, people should know my answer is no. Right, but I don't say it. They said obviously. And going back, if for those of you, if you go back to These Bones Will Rise Again, there's a specific part In the book that I examine, or we're driving with my uncle, we're going through, you know, sort of farmlands, and we're listening to Murimi Munu, right, which is a Oluva Mtukudzi song, which is a farmer is a person. Right. And that's the first time I'm really thinking about this question of Ubuntu as a critical philosophy or African critical philosophy of race. And he writes the song, or the song is released in the moment of land reform. And so you have to ask yourself, what does Tuku mean to say a farmer or the planter is a person? Who is the person he's referring to in that moment? Right. And that's the thing about Tuku speaking in double voices. And that's what I'm also doing. And very often Black people in the modern world are always speaking in double voices. So here is to say that Ubuntu that has been whitewashed from us, right? Ubuntu that becomes this airy fairy, which, you know, kind of kumbaya ideology, particularly in the post-1994 period in South Africa, having been popularized by Desmond Tutu in the face of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, right? And so many of us grow up then pushing against Ubuntu because every time we want to say anything, and pushing against Ubuntu, Tutu, Mandela, because every time we want to say anything about race in South Africa, it is but Ubuntu, right? But then we have a generation of scholars who then go back and say, actually, let's really, really go back to what does Ubuntu know? Because the problem is that we have Ubuntu without Abantu, right? Meaning we have Ubuntu without the people from which it comes from. Meaning us Black people, that Ubuntu has been dispossessed of its deeply radical commitments to social and historical ethics. And part of what it means, and part of what I go through in this piece, is even to go back to the fact that the problem that we have is that when we try to make one of the first is an epistemological problem, when we're trying to push or pull African philosophy into West analogs of Western philosophy. So going back to John Beattie saying, I am because we are, which I'm saying is the wrong translation of Umuntu Muntu Ngabantu. It says a person is a person through others, very different meanings. It sounds trivial, but it's important, right? And within then you know that what it means is that personhood is always something that you're working towards. And part of Ubuntu, if we then systematize it and think about it very critically, it operates at the interpersonal and the societal level. Interpersonally, many of us will know the Ubuntu, which means that when I misbehave, my mother will say, Itamunu, be a person. Because part of being a person is upholding the personhood of other people. So you can fail at personhood. You have to consistently work at it. And when you want to praise someone, you say, ah, Munu, they are a person. Meaning that you do not take for granted personhood. It is always something, it's being. It is becoming, not being. It's not a stationary site. So just on the virtue of being a human does not mean you're a person. It is something you have to work towards, which is why I say, ah, Ningi, Azoita Munu, this person has become a person. My cousin got married the other day and we were laughing, and he got married a bit older. And he says, ah, finally, you are now a person, you know, because personhood is social. You are not a person abstractly, unlike Descartes. So this is what Mbiti was doing. I think, therefore I am, which is the model of a Western epistemology and Western enlightenment, is that I think, therefore I am. It is a person or an individual, a white man, who is removed from society, and just by virtue of his rationality, that is where his humanity comes from, right? And which is why I think it's important. The Western conception of the human is very different from the African conception of a person. One is social, one is about rationality, but it's an oppositional rationality, right? I explained some of this in the piece. But now why this becomes important is that there is also a historical level too when we talk about Abantu and personhood, right? And Ubuntu, which is why this is a part of the problem with what the whitewashing of Ubuntu means, that people don't even know African languages, but they want to philosophize about it. You don't even hear the language that these people are speaking. And yet you'd never do that. You'd never dare think about that for Western philosophy. You cannot tell yourself you're a serious philosopher of French or let's say Enlightenment or Kantian theories, but you don't speak German. You wouldn't do that. You'd be laughed out of, you know, once we were students, and it was funny because Mbembe was saying, oh, well, you know, you guys want to talk about Fanon, but you haven't even read the French. And we didn't like what he said. But now I go back, it's like, he's right, because language is a cosmology. You cannot just simply make analogs and there's important things that you miss. But importantly, why this is important, is that if you listen to Black people speaking every day, we're making commentary through the terms of Ubuntu, to saying that when we speak amongst ourselves as Black people, across Southern Africa, you hear that if you want to say, if we're in a room and we're saying, they say there was a white colleague, I'll say, ah, Munwere, was that a person? You say, no, Murungu. Mm-hmm. No, that was a white person. You can have that in Sotho, you can have that in Zulu, but it's a commentary on the fact that we historically do not regard them as people. It's not about humanity, it's about we don't regard them as people because they do not, they fail to treat us with Ubuntu. They've failed to treat Abantu with Ubuntu. By virtue of land conquest, so we're going back to that Tuku song, by virtue of the conquest of land starting in 1652, starting in 1819 in Zimbabwe, by virtue of apartheid, by virtue of the continued dispossession of Black people, right? Where white people own Black people own 1% of land in South Africa, for example, or the fact that we were forced in Zimbabwe to pay back farmers, right? White farmers. That's part of the lack of Ubuntu. Right. And that's why we do not consider them to be people, because we don't follow the same code of ethics. Right. So it is a critical philosophy of race that is based not in skin color, but is based in or the body or biology, which is what Western philosophies of race are based on. But it is based in social and historical ethics. So in the piece, I'm saying that they can become people. But in order to become people, so i.e. in order for white South Africans or white settlers to no longer be settlers in Africa, but to be people in Africa, you have to begin to undo the things that made you not be people in the first place, i.e. conquest. So i.e. we're talking about land redistribution as a beginning. We're talking about a whole range of things, undoing the anti-Black nature of society. Then we can begin to talk of you as people. Yes. Right? It's a social and ethical judgment, which yes. we hear across our languages. That's what the piece is getting across. So there were many white South Africans who were extremely upset with me. Why? Because they know that they don't want to do what needs to be done. Mm. Right? Because it's too much. Because you thought Ubuntu just meant, oh, fantastic. These people are just so generous. No, in our own culture, again, if you this thing of having Ubuntu without Abantu, it means that. What you don't take our culture, you have Ubuntu without Isintu, right? Meaning Ubuntu without the culture, the philosophies that actually undergird it. Meaning that in our cultures, I mean, we're talking about the fact that in my family, whatever my parents or some elders had done, they had wronged my grandmother. You don't say sorry with your mouth. That's what we know in our culture, right? Aungoti sorry nemuromu. Chatoripa, you're going to, you don't say sorry with your mouth. You kuripa in Shona is to pay a fine or uklawula, as you say in Nguni languages. There must be reparation. That's why you go to the Ndaba. That's why you go to you know, you have to do something. Utolisangani, what are you apologizing? What are you atoning with? That's the crucial step that was missed in this conversation of reconciliation. Yes, we can reconcile. But what are you bringing to the table to show your atonement and to repair me and restore me in the position that you found me in? Mm. So the thing about Ubuntu is that it's highly demanding, just like on a daily basis, your mother saying, be a person. It's demanding to be a person. you can't take it for granted. Just like at the historical level, it is incredibly demanding, which is why they were upset with me, because they could not, they know they're not willing to live up to those demands. They want the nice kumbaya Ubuntu, which is just Africans, we just forget. No, we don't ask for forgiveness with your mouth.
And you say it very well. And even for us, even when your cows go and eat your neighbor's maize, you don't just go and say sorry and you continue living your life. No. When the harvest comes, you harvest, you eat with your children, and this one is hungry, they must just appreciate the sorry. When you harvest, you have to take some bags of maize to this place where your cows ate, and you give them so that they can also eat with their children. You say sorry, but you give maize for this one. So you can see this Eurocentric, that you can just say sorry, or you can be taken to prison, and then you continue with you. And that's why even when they we are post-colonial. They think that, okay, we can keep land. We just say, okay, now you have your independence, but as we keep the wealth and so forth. That's really interesting. I really loved that.
So I think that's the thing. So it seemed perhaps like it. I think, yes, the framing, I think what they wanted as the editors was to, you know, bring people in. And I think many people were in for a rude awakening, which I really began with the fact that we don't consider you people in our cultures. And that's not the biological racist assessment. It's because of your lack of ethics, historical social ethics, and continuing lack of ethics. It's an unethical existence that you have, unethical existence of conquest. Mm. That is what we need to speak about with Ubuntu. And so they're having that radical ethics recentered in the discourse of Ubuntu, not the Christianized Ubuntu that came in the 1994 period, right? Or post-1994. And that's really important. And everything in our cultures we do, you say, don't say I love you with your mouth. Show me you love me. What are you doing? Even to say, Ndakurangari, or I remembered you, Ndakukumbula. How? I sent you groceries. I remembered you. Right?
Yes.
That is part of our culture, to say that you don't just speak and you don't do. It must be shown, right? Yeah. What your intentions are. And you must be invested in my well-being. And they're not, which is what then is being shown up. I mean, there was the piece was republished in the Sunday Times in South Africa. And the next week, they wrote about the fact that they had so many letters that they couldn't even publish them all, but then they did the next week because they were so upset. The same people who profess to love Ubuntu are angry with me for saying that, in fact, Ubuntu requires this, and say, yes, you want to do Ubuntu, let us go and do the process. Let us go, Fudare, Agatite Matare, right? Let's go to the Indaba and
let's
talk
about the tree.
Let's go to Matare, Tite Matare, and talk about this is what we require. Mm-hmm. You have wronged me. I mean, in my family, there was some funny case where, I don't know, words are important, right? Because it goes at the level of, it's not just you ate, what do you call it, that the mombe, the cow ate the chibage and that kind of thing. It is also people, you saying the saying things that are injurious to people through your words. You will be forced to go and pay reparations for that. So there's reparations not just for taking land, but it's also for the anti-Black metaphysics that you brought into, the anti-Black culture that you've brought into society. Those are the things you also have to account for, right? I mean, we had a family function where I think it was a wedding, and then the groom, I think my aunt had said something like, oh, you know, the groom, the bride is so lucky. She's coming to a family that is so Christian, so we really pray, whatever. And the family thought, what are you saying about us? Are you saying that we're not Christian or what, you know, something like that? But then they were taken to go to Matari, they were taken to Matari, and they had to pay reparations. So how can you say that? What are you trying to say about us? The point, and they had to go and pay reparation. The point being that there are multiple levels, that it accounts for the metaphysical and the material damage.
Yes. And I was really going to ask you how it was received, but you have commented.
I mean, Black people loved it because I think, but more important, there was a registered court. Okay, yes, I don't believe that whites can do what they need to do. They won't do it. And my work in liberation does not depend on white allies. I'm not interested in that. Mm. Right. I'm interested in talking to Black people first and foremost. The lack of Black institutions and media platforms often means that sometimes you'll have to use a white platform, knowing that that's what you will reach a wider Black audience with, mm. right? Fortunately, unfortunately, we speak in different registers in different places, right? Mm. And so for me, I didn't really care about what happened with the white audience. They're upset, fine. But what was more interesting and more important for me was for Black people to be able to reclaim our cosmologies, our ethics, our culture, and say, actually, this thing that has been dispossessed, because Black people have been dispossessed of Ubuntu, mm. it was to say, let us reclaim this thing. Mm. This is ours. We cannot allow these people to take this along with the land, and then they, no, you can't. That's what, so ultimately, I was most intent on speaking to Black people. Mm. But such is the dance of speaking in public, we have to speak in many registers. Mm-hmm. Yes, sometimes I'm going to be more straightforward, but sometimes also then in having to go through, because the problem is that they're also Black people who believe some of those things. I don't always talk to them, but sometimes you also have to walk through people through to say, okay, how do you get to a point where you can see that understanding their lack of personhood is not about you being a so-called reverse racist, which doesn't exist in the first place, but how do you get there intellectually to understand and emotionally, spiritually to understand what is being done to you? So that's my primary audience, is always Black people. Sometimes I might have to put in some things here and there because it makes it easier for a platform, you know, but it also then means that if it's published in The Guardian, for example, it is easier, for example, for it to reach Black people in the UK, Black people in the US, you know, that kind of thing, because I'm interested in speaking to Black people everywhere. That's my audience. Sometimes it's going to be a more insular conversation where I'm like, okay, Mazimbabwean, Gatitaure, sometimes it's going to be that. Sometimes it's going to be, but, you know, it's there's different registers for different places. And some things are not, if there's some conversations that I will never have on a white platform. There's some intra-Black conversations that I just cannot have there because framing and platform is important. And I think it's those kind of things are very, they're very political, but we have to think about that. It's not just about us becoming writers and having our voices published. We must think about our institutions. That even goes about universities, that goes about a whole range of places, because there's a huge problem in us then divesting ourselves and creating the mean or divesting ourselves of the means of ownership. Is a really, really big problem. We can have that conversation another day, but I think it's something to think about as writers, as people, or as knowledge disseminators, as storytellers, platform institutions is really, really, really important.
Thank you very much, Panache. This was wonderful talking to you. I really enjoyed this conversation with you, and I'm very grateful that you were able to come and speak with me at Sawira Africa Global Summit. I look forward to bring you sometime here to the Nordic. Thank you.
I just want to say thank you so much. This is what we're talking about platforms. Thank you so much for creating this for us, creating our space and deciding that, you know what, we as Black women, as African women need to come together. So I just really want to thank you for your vision and your work in this particular platform. But just historically, you're doing so much for us. And I'm so grateful to you and for the audience today. This is really, really fantastic.
That was Dr. Faith Mkwesha and Mujare Panache Chukwumati. A big thank you to both of them for that highly interesting and enlightening conversation. Indeed, they gave us a lot to chew on, and we look forward to many more conversations of this kind. The voices in the opening sequence were those of some of the presenters who we hope to be featuring in episodes to come. We had Professor Akachi T. Ezebo, who writes creatively under the pen name Akachi Ademora Ezebo. She is a professor of English, multiple award-winning writer and international scholar. Her presentation title was Collective Feminine Healing, Snail Sense Feminism as a Workable Concept for Decolonization. Then there was Mama Tebogo Bantu, who is a community educator and practitioner within African-centered knowledge and healing in her capacity as the director of Ebukosini Solutions. She was speaking on Kandaka, womanism, womb healing, and Sankofa theory as a celebration of femininity in a patriarchal world. We also had Paola Minoa, who is a senior lecturer in global development studies at the University of Helsinki and an associate professor in political and economic geography at the University of Turin. She spoke on humanizing academia, unlearning and relearning academic practices through co-motherhood and sawirahood. Finally, we had Dr. Mamohau Sekgapane, whose career history spans over 25 years in private, public, business, and academic institutions. Her key areas of speciality are organizational change and development, change management, leadership, culture, and innovation aligned to strategy, vision, technology, people, and systems. And her topic was Rebirth Epistemological Archetype as Transformation and Innovation Tool for Systems Post-COVID-19 Epidemic, a New Normal Adaptation Model. As aforementioned, we were indeed in the company of great and powerful women from many parts of the world, and for that we give thanks. Once again, it is a great pleasure to have had the opportunity to revisit the Global Summit, which we had on the 24th and 25th of May in 2022, courtesy of Sawira Africa International in partnership with the Center for Research on Ethnic Relations and Nationalism, CERN, the Swedish School of Social Science, and the University of Helsinki. We thank you for joining us in going down memory lane and receiving once again the gifts that were shared by these dynamic women who are agents of change. Please do join us for our next installment here on SciPod. You can find us on the various social media platforms, Spotify, as well as the Sawira Africa International website, sawira-africa.org. Thank you once again for being with us. We look forward to sharing more with you in future. My name is Amkelwa Mbekeni Kapanen. Till next time, peace and blessings.